All right, guys, welcome to the show. This is, right now it is an End of the Apocalypse episode, but it may become a Deborah Gets Red-Pilled episode. Who knows? She just texted me. I don't know if she's coming on. But what's going on, dude? How's it going?
That's going good. I just yesterday, I listened to the newest episode of Deborah Gets Red-Pilled without me. When Lanny was on, you guys did the one on health there.
Yeah.
That was pretty awesome. I was really, really proud of you, you know, for Pride Month and all, coming out of your former vegetarian closet and letting us know that you were a vegetarian just for Pride Month, man.
I was vegan.
You were vegan.
Yeah.
Dude, that's so pride-like.
Yeah. Yeah. I did not have good results.
Yeah, it didn't sound like it. I never knew that about you. I was vegetarian for a long period of time and vegan at times, all trying to straighten out health shit that didn't work at all. Of course, I kept going back to drinking throughout those times, which didn't help anything, I'm sure. But yeah, you know what sucks about, I don't want to say about vegetarianism, but you know what sucks is PETA. You ever dive into PETA at all?
I know that they are not the best. I know that they like fund a bunch of kill shelters and stuff like that, but I don't know like the full depth of what they do.
Oh, they're pretty, you can go pretty deep on how fucked up they are. But if you just accept that as a statement from me, one of the worst things from my point of view is just that they they put out those videos of farms and how fucked up they are, slaughterhouses and stuff like that, that are really impactful. And they're really right.
What was that? What's that one that, they call it the vegan maker. It's the one that,
shows Joaquin, all the chicks.
Joaquin Phoenix is the narrator. It's called, it's not Sapiens. That's a book by that transhumanist guy. It's called Earthlings maybe.
Okay. And that's a PETA video?
I don't know if it's PETA, but it's like full vegan propaganda because it just shows like slaughterhouses and stuff like that. It's really disturbing.
It's that stuff. I don't know if I've seen that specific one or not, but I've seen a bunch of those and they're really impactful. And it sucks that they're so correct. I mean, that kind of stuff I think does need to be exposed. People like you and me who are moving in the directions that we're moving in, we can really see how fucked up the commercial slaughterhouses are and feedlots and, you know, the way that the commercial animals are being pushed through is like really terrible.
Yeah, I don't think you'd find any argument from people like us about that either.
No, exactly. And then you have people like PETA who put out videos to expose that, and if PETA gets their way, you and I wouldn't be allowed to do what we do either. You know, they group it all together. They don't see, they honestly, if you go really on what they are into and what they fund, they don't see a difference between those slaughterhouses and someone owning a dog.
Yeah.
Like they don't want people to have pets.
I didn't know that. That's crazy. Yeah.
They don't think that, like you were saying, they fund kill shelters. Well, they are a kill shelter. They believe in putting any animals that have been domesticated, they believe in putting them down. And they don't think people should own pets. And they think everyone should be vegetarian. And that's where it gets really messed up, because what percentage of people who donate to PETA aren't even vegetarian, but they, oh, I'm a dog lover, therefore I like PETA. The people against it. What is it? People ethical, for ethical for treatment, ethical treatment
of animals. Yeah. Okay, you froze up, buddy. There you go.
My back.
Yeah.
Well, that sucks. It's same message came up. I think we're gonna have to deal with this for another round.
It's all good.
I apologize.
No worries.
But yeah, they get all these people who are pet owners, pet lovers, animal lovers, who donate to them. but they don't realize, like, PETA has been convicted of dumping dead dogs in dumpsters that don't belong to them because their freezer gets too backed up from all the dead dogs that they have at their facility because they can't keep up with the crematorium to burn all the dead dogs that they kill, which they do by taking out no kill shelters, and they take all the dogs and they put them all down.
Are they getting government funding for this stuff?
Boy, it's been a long time since I've dived in, like more than 10 years, like 15 years since I really went hard against PETA. But at that time, I don't remember overturning a stone that told me they were being funded by the government.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't surprise me if they have been or are now at some point in time.
They're probably some sort of 501c3 or I don't even know what that means, but one of those ones where they're like tax exempt and all that, nonprofit.
Oh, surely, you know? they're at least a nonprofit.
Yeah.
You know, I think they're pretty much some of the scum of the earth. Mostly because of that deceit. You know, if they told people, hey, we're PETA, we're for the ethical treatment of animals, and we don't think that you should have pets, and then people still donated, okay, you know, that's whatever. But the problem is that they rope so many people in and people don't know what they're supporting. And yeah. In fact, a lot of those people who are donating to them probably also donate to things like no kill shelters because they're like, oh, I love animals, but they're funding the no kill shelter. And then they're funding the people who are like, that's their main thing is busting up no kill shelters.
Yeah. That's so crazy that they don't even want pets. I can't even understand what the logic is behind it. I mean, I know what they'd say, but it doesn't make any sense to me. I mean,
I forget her name off the top of my head. One of the top women who run the deal or used to 15 years ago is diabetic and uses pig insulin like multiple times a day. And I've watched her on video say straight up like, yes, I use this, but I am using this to keep myself alive, to help keep animals being treated ethically, therefore, like, I see this as okay, but no one else should be using this insulin. And it's like, did you just say that? You know, like, you think that you should be able to use the insulin extracted from an animal.
It's so crazy. They just are totally fine saying the quiet part out loud.
That was a long time ago that I dived in, and it might have been one of the first times that I really started to see that there's this group of people who have no problem with hypocrisy. They have no problem with it. They can say one thing all day and then turn and be like, well, I'm going to do something different and I don't care. You know, like, that's what you and me see a lot in the left in general now.
Yeah.
I didn't see that much at that time. And that was, I mean, blew my fucking mind back then, but now I'm kind of like, yeah, that's par for the course.
Yeah. Did you see Thomas Massey interviewing Jerry Nadler? They're not interviewing him. It's like those like gotcha moments from Congress or whatever, where they're doing like those congressional hearings, and it's either like Thomas Massey or Rand Paul or Jim Jordan just making people look stupid, even though nothing ever comes out of it.
I might have.
It's recent, and they're talking about this whole assault weapons. It's not making them illegal, but making it like you got to be 21 to buy an AR-15 instead of 18. And Jerry Nadler, you know who that guy is, right?
Oh, yeah,
the guy who craps himself and like pulls his pants up to above his pants. It's so insane. It's so insane that we're being ruled by geriatrics. It's insane.
And we're not really being, I don't think we're really being ruled by them.
Right.
Did I freeze?
No, you're borderline frozen, but you're still up. So Thomas Massey, Jerry Nadler is like talking about like how you shouldn't be able to have a AR-15 until you're 21 because your brain isn't formed, you know? And so Thomas Massey goes, okay, Mr. Nadler, would you be willing to co-sponsor a bill with me that would postpone draft age, the selective service, to 21 years old? And he goes, absolutely not. And he goes, but why, if your brain isn't formed? And he goes, because the government needs bodies.
Doesn't matter if your brain's formed or not. Let's apply. I thought you were going to say, or that he was going to say, for voting, we need to, am I frozen?
No, you're good, man.
But did I lose you?
No, you're good. So,
oh, okay. You're freezing on my side now.
Yeah.
But for voting, because like, how can we have people without fully formed brains voting on this important, the sacred democratic system that we have?
Yeah. So he goes, after he follows that up with, he's like, no, because we need, the government needs them in the case of war. And he's like, they need people with unformed brains for war. And he goes, yes. He's like, no more questions.
Saying the quiet part out loud.
Yeah. And it's so disgusting. And that guy's like, you know, king shit of the Democrats, you know, like the anti-war left, you know.
Yep.
It's really, really getting wild out there.
Yeah, do you hear about Justin Bieber?
Yeah.
Face paralysis.
Yeah. And that's like whatever version of that Ghislaine Barr or what's the other thing they call it? Bell's palsy, whatever version he has is like from shingles.
Yeah.
And people that are getting vaccinated are getting shingles.
Mm-hmm.
So, and his girlfriend had a stroke or something a couple months ago too.
Bieber's girlfriend did?
Yeah.
Oh wow. Yeah. Yeah, we're really normalizing some fucked up medical conditions. Here locally, we just had our big, it's called Sea to Ski race, where people, or Ski to Sea, they start at the mountain and go all the way to the water. And perfectly healthy 55-year-old athlete who's run this year over year for forever, just died during the thing. The picture that they're putting on all the papers around here is a selfie that he took right before starting his leg of the event. And he's like got a thumbs up, like he looks like he's ready to go. But they don't even say what he died of. It was just he died from a medical emergency.
Yeah.
That's it.
Have you seen all this stuff about sudden adult death syndrome, SADS?
SADS. It's like SIDS, but SADS.
Yeah.
It's very sad. It really is.
Very sad, yeah.
It's the first time I saw that, I was like, that can't be fucking real. SADS? Like, that they would, like, so like do they, what the fuck? And I look it up, and like, sure enough, it's a thing. Has been for some time, but it's ramping up, I guess.
Yeah, it's really getting weird out there. I don't know. I went into Portland yesterday. It's just, it's so gross. It's like what we talked about with Travis. It's just like, if you don't participate in it on a daily basis and you forget about it and then you like go, it's wild, man. It's like so crazy when your brain starts going back to not rationalizing people living in that manner, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Did you see anything of note while you were there? Anything
just the norm, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know about there, and I don't know that you have a baseline to look at it by, but the masks here are ramping up more and more every time I'm out.
I was over in Washington yesterday for the day before doing errands at, you know, my normal couple stores. And it looked like, it's not, you know, it's nowhere near like even 50% there, but I could tell there was more than normal.
Than what it had gotten to.
Yeah. And I wonder what it is, if it's monkeypox or if it's just people repeating the line that cases are going up
Hey, speaking of monkeypox, I heard Bill Maher said something controversial
about the trans stuff.
About he said I'm not, I didn't see this myself. Friend of mine watched it, I think maybe just yesterday. I don't know when he airs or what, but he'd just seen it. And he said that he was arguing whatever, and monkeypox came up, and he said he's not buying into the whole monkeypox thing. He doesn't care. He doesn't give a shit if someone fucked a goddamn monkey. And I guess it was like a big deal. Like, oh shit, you're using that old argument, pulling it up from the old AIDS days, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they're saying it's a gay party disease, I guess, is what they're saying.
Which I think is why that would be controversial to say someone fucked a monkey, just like people used to say, just like the official narrative was at one point, I think, I don't know, of AIDS, was that some black dude in Africa fucked a monkey and then went to a bathhouse. And that's...
All right. You're a little frozen again.
That's how AIDS got started.
Yeah. Okay, you're back.
No, I should be back. Whenever I get a message that says my internet is unstable, that means I'm back. Yeah. I don't understand it. I thought this cord would do the trick. I think I'm going to leave it the way it is. It doesn't seem worse than it's been.
No, it's pretty normal.
But like I said, I did this seconds before we started, so it'll take me some time when we're not recording to get it all hammered out, I hope.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, I don't think anybody fucked a monkey. I think it's just shingles, right? Just shingles. Yeah, that's getting vaccinated or something.
Kind of what I gotten for my very, I don't even think I should say dive. I was going to say surface level dive, but I've like looked at Wikipedia. That's about it.
Yeah.
What are we getting, Deborah?
Yeah, Deborah rushed home.
Are we transitioning from into the apocalypse to Deborah gets red pilled?
It is a Deborah gets red pilled episode as of now.
All right.
She's there.
Hi.
Hey.
I gotta make some sort of better way to know.
Well, we have a calendar. It should have your don't you check your Gmail?
Yes, I do.
Does it tell you
calendar?
Yeah. It does it link to the calendar that we set up for you? Okay. But yeah, so I don't know. How's the weather up there, man?
Yeah, it's freaking beautiful now. After 2 days ago, we had about an inch and a quarter in a day of rain.
Yeah.
And then I had a window yesterday where I was able to get some lawn mowed and things like that. Then today it's beautiful. And I was looking so forward to getting a bunch of stuff done before coming on, but I didn't get home till time to start. So
yeah, the sun's out now, but it's been raining pretty steady for the past few days, like raining hard.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Only 90 degrees here.
Yeah.
Do you have a rain gauge, Adam?
No.
I recommend you get one.
Okay.
It's fun.
Yeah.
If nothing else, it's nice to kind of like have a gauge on what's going on. You can know this is how much rain that was when it fell like this, you know. I don't know. It gives you a cool way to monitor what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, I should do that. But it's, yeah, we definitely don't have any sort of drought conditions here, even though our governor tells us that we're in a massive drought, you know. I don't know. Rain's like an inch a week here, no matter what time of year it is. So
yeah, they're telling us we're facing the worst drought that our county has ever seen this year. Yeah. It has to do with the melting of a specific glacier on the mountain that sits in our background. So I don't know. I don't know what to believe.
Yeah, I don't believe any of that. But I don't know. I went to the dump today. I got a ton of trash out of my house. And I always get scared. It's like going to the store without wearing a mask. I always get scared when I go to the dump because I'm disposing of things that I'm not supposed to be disposing of at the dump.
If it's small enough, you put it inside a box of other stuff with some crap on top, and then
I just put a ton of asbestos tiles into black bags.
There you go.
I threw one out of my truck today though, and it like burst open. Mm-hmm. I'm like, oh shit! So I like just like threw all the other stuff on top of it. Like got out of there as fast as I could. Paid with cash, so I didn't have my name on file.
Yeah, and, you'll know it's bad when you get to where you remove your plates before going into the dump.
Yeah. At that point, I will take trips to Portland and just drop off bags under bridges all over town. You know. But our guest is here. So ChudX, you set up this this interview, and you know mm-hmm. more about this subject than the two of us put together. And so you lead the way, and we will follow along.
Okay, got it. Sounds good.
Okay, yeah. Let's pause. We'll let him in. All right, guys, we're back. And today for our guest, ChudX set up this this interview. David Matheson is here to talk to us about astrotheology. Welcome to the show, David.
Hey, thanks very much, Adam, ChudX, and Deborah. Very good to meet you. I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah, we really appreciate you being here. Astrotheology is a topic that we've covered a few times on the show. The original presenter I don't really trust very much, so I've had a kind of a mental block on it. I don't have much of a history of looking at the sky or knowing what's going on up there. I'm trying to change all that. And ChudX knows a lot more than me. And
I know even less.
Yeah. So I think you know more than me, Deborah. But yeah, so we're kind of going to kind of defer to you two. And yeah, why don't you guys take it away?
Yeah. All right. Well, David, why don't you start by giving us a rundown of what this concept of astrotheology is?
Sure. Well, I don't actually use that term astrotheology myself too much. I have used it. It's useful in some ways, and it's got some drawbacks as well. But really, there was my opinion, the first use of that term came from, there was a preacher in England. He was a ordained minister, a pastor, whose name was Robert Taylor, the Reverend Robert Taylor. And he basically got kicked out of the church for preaching that the Bible stories are all based on the stars. And so he basically lost his income, I think is probably what happened. He was even thrown in jail a few times for a total of 3 years altogether, not all at once, but altogether. And so he started doing lectures. He called them lectures or sermons in big kind of public halls about the Bible being based on the stars. And after he died, those were collected into two different volumes that you can find online, because he died in, I think, 1835. So this is all pretty old.
And
you
stuff.
You can read it all online. And one volume is called The Devil's Pulpit, because I guess he was, you know, he was criticized quite a bit for what he was doing. And it was said that he was, you know, preaching from the devil's pulpit. And the other one is called Astronomico-Theological Lectures. So astronomico-theological is a mouthful, and it got shortened down, I think, to astrotheology. And I think there are one or two places where he kind of uses that phrase, astrotheological. But either way, I recognize Robert Taylor as a real pioneer, and in fact, one of the best that I've seen. There's various types of analysis that has come along since. Some better than others and some worse than others. And there's a lot of what I kind of call shallow astrotheology. I did write a book once called Astrotheology for Life. So I've got about 10 books. And one of them, I did use that title, Astrotheology. It's called Astrotheology for Life. And I talk a little bit about the problem with shallow astrotheology. It usually just recognizes the zodiac wheel, and it's primarily only negative. It says, oh, you know, this shows that the scriptures are just related to the stars and probably for planting crops or something like that, which is to me just ridiculous. You know, you don't need all these plethora of stories to know when winter is over and spring is here. It is just not, is not a good explanation.
Would but you put, those things might be in there, but that's just a little icing, not yeah, the substance.
Yeah, would you put, we don't need these complex stories for that. Go ahead, Adam.
Would you put Zeitgeist into that group?
So Zeitgeist is an interesting one, and probably I would categorize it as fairly shallow astrotheology. But anyway, I haven't said what astrotheology is. And I use the term star myths more commonly.
Yeah.
Because the word theology already has some baggage along with it. And also that phrase astrotheology is sometimes used to mean completely different things. There's a whole kind of genre of literature imagining what will happen to Christianity or what will happen to different faiths when we find aliens. And they call that astrotheology, which is totally different from what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is that the ancient scriptures are based on the stars. And by the way, another reason why I call it star myths instead of astrotheology is this system can be seen and can be shown in myths around the world. This unites all the different ancient scriptures and myths and sacred stories of cultures on every inhabited continent, from Africa, Asia, the Americas, also the islands of the Pacific, you know, the vast Pacific. There's the Polynesian culture with the myths of Maui, and those stories are based on the same, and also New Zealand is part of the Polynesian culture. Ancient China, ancient Japan, ancient Mesopotamia, ancient India, you know, the thousands of scriptures of ancient India and the thousands of gods and goddesses are using this same system. So again, when I say like shallow astrotheology, sometimes just focuses only on the Bible and says, oh, see, the Bible is just there to trick you. And that's kind of what Zeitgeist kind of says, oh, you know, the Federal Reserve is there to enslave you, and the Bible is just there to enslave you, you know, with this, you know, this story of rising in 3 days. And then they tie that into basically the winter solstice, which it is connected to the winter solstice. I'm not saying that there's nothing right about that, but it doesn't go very far, and it's primarily negative. It's just saying, when they use the word just, you know, this story about Jesus rising in 3 days is just about the winter solstice. That's reductive. Actually, what these things are, they're actually esoteric and positive and uplifting, but they have been twisted and used to for negative purposes too. But anyway, so just for I'll finish talking and let you guys talk, but just to really kind of boil it down to a very short explanation, my understanding of what I call the star myths of the world, and obviously I didn't invent this, I don't claim to be the first to discover this. I just talked about Robert Taylor, but we can find passages in Plato and other ancient philosophers that are hinting at this as well, that the world's ancient myths, the Greek myths included, the Norse myths, and sacred stories and scriptures. Some cultures wrote them down. Some cultures had more of an oral tradition. All the world's ancient sacred traditions are based on some common system. A common system, very ancient, was already in place by ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, ancient India, based on the stars. And when I say based on the stars, I mean the figures in those stories, Moses, Adam and Eve, Krishna, Arjun, Thor, can all be shown to be based on constellations. So they're based on the stars and the heavenly cycles, and it's an esoteric system, which means it's like a code. It's like a language that is worldwide.
Yeah, that's beautiful. See, This appeals to me so much because I was raised Christian, and then I kind of threw out everything I learned in Christianity at a young age and kind of rebuilt a lot of what I thought, and it's constantly rebuilding still. But some of my earlier thoughts in that rebuilding was that, like, oh, I think all these religions are sort of the same thing, but that they're cultural spins in different directions, you know? So between with like that, and then, you know, later adding in this idea of that being connected to the stars, I dig that, especially as in more recent times, I've become a bit of a sky gazer. You know, I look at the sky both day and night for a number of reasons. And it wasn't until that time that I really felt that I started unlocking my own spirituality and finding my own true self in a lot of ways. And the idea that all these religions, none of them are wrong. They're all kind of work together, and that they're all connected to the sky is just, it's like this, it really, really appeals to me like that. So, you know, hearing your rundown there, I mean, I think this sounds like a great opening. What do you think so far, Deborah?
Well, I'm wondering, was there a certain point in time when people kind of stopped looking up and were, you know, filtered into Christianity or Judaism or what have you?
A very good question. Very good question. So let me say first, just to enhance a little bit, based off of something that Chud X just said, you want me to call you that or by your...
Chud works.
Right on. Yeah, you know, there's a character in the scriptures who gets his name changed, you know, that you've got, that your parents, you know, named you after is really interesting. That's I would argue is related to Apollo, right?
Yeah,
Apollo.
Yeah.
But anyhow, and you know, Saul is related to the sun, solar. But and I'll get to your question. It's a great question, Deborah. So, but one thing that you said, I didn't want to let it just slip by, Chud, is the how you've felt that watching the cycles of the sky both day and night has helped you get back to yourself. And that is very profound statement, because the other part I didn't say in my definition, but over the years of looking at this, I've become convinced that one of the central messages of this ancient system, these ancient stories, is about recovery of self. And there are modern healers, doctors, psychologists who talk about trauma, psychological trauma, as being a separation from self. And we're actually living in a very trauma-inducing society. And you can see the symptoms of that everywhere. And we can see the symptoms of that within ourselves. But trauma is not just separation from self, because once we get separated from our own self, and by the way, you can see it right in the Adam and Eve story, right? At first, the scriptures actually say they're naked and unashamed. They're totally happy with who they are. And then pretty soon, Adam's pointing fingers at Eve and saying, well, she did it. And they're divided from one another. And then they're divided against themselves. They're ashamed of themselves and covering themselves up. And they're divided from the Almighty, and they're divided from nature. At first, they were integrated with nature. So when we lose our connection with ourself, we also lose connection with others in our family, with others in the human family. We become divided away from, first from ourself, then from others, and from nature, and from the invisible or the divine realm. All those things are like a cascading effect of separation from self. The ancient scriptures actually depict this, and they point us towards recovery of self, and they use the heavens and the cycles of the heavens, and recovery of self leads to recovery of potential for connection with others, the wider human family, nature, just like you're describing, and with the invisible realm. So that's a super important point. And when we're traumatized also, we have a harder time like perceiving things because we're divided from ourself. Like ourself already knows, but our little like protective voices will say, oh, no, that's, you know, the government couldn't possibly have done that, you know, couldn't possibly be involved in that because it's too terrifying.
Sure.
So when you're divided from yourself, you're more easy to fool or more easy to manipulate, more easy to push your buttons and control you like a puppet. So anyway, now to Deborah's excellent question of what happened to this knowledge, if it's assuming it's correct, and I'll show you some evidence. You know, it's a really interesting concept for the show of quote unquote, Deborah gets, you know, red pilled. I'm not actually running around trying to red pill anyone who's happily basing their identity on the faith that they were brought up in or that they were led to or came to. I'm not really running around trying to quote red pill anybody, but for people who are looking, and this is a very important subject, I think it's a huge subject that touches all of human history. I'm putting this out there for those who are looking for it, but I'm not like aggressively going and trying to step on anybody's belief system.
You're not trying to wake anybody up and say, this is the way it is.
Well, you know, I think people who are looking, you know, sure, I am, this has been tremendously beneficial in my own life. And I was also taking the Bible literally to your point, Chad, of what you were saying. Actually, I wasn't raised in a strictly religious or overly religious, you know, we went to church once in a while. It was while I was in the army, which is also a traumatic kind of a, you know, like deliberately traumatic kind of environment for, you know, good reasons, not to get off on a tangent, but the army and literalism sometimes go hand in hand. Anyway, I became much more literalist Christian in the army than I ever had been growing up. And that was like about 20 years of my life of believing the Bible literally and reading only the Bible on Sundays. I wouldn't, you know, watch any sports. I wouldn't read any, you know, Dante, Milton, or Shakespeare on Sunday, even when I was getting a graduate degree in literature and having to read a whole lot of things. Anyway, but Deborah's question is a great one. And after I show, you know, all this evidence, we can maybe return to it as well. But just up front, I don't know what happened. Okay. No, none of anyone who is really certain on this subject, I'm suspicious of when they're like, well, this obviously came from, you know, the Anunnaki came down and this is, no, actually the Anunnaki is like a literalistic interpretation of something that's clearly based on the stars. All those Mesopotamian stories are also based on the same system. But what I can say is that this system is in place in the Gilgamesh epic, very demonstrably. And that's one of the most ancient texts that we have. And there's another ancient Sumerian text called the Descent of Inanna, the goddess Inanna. She's a goddess of love and beauty, and she goes down to the underworld, which is a common pattern in myth around the world.
Persephone, yeah.
Yeah, Persephone. Odysseus does it in the Odyssey. Baldur goes down to the underworld, and the son of Odin has to go down and try and get him out, unsuccessful. A lot of times it's unsuccessful. There's Orpheus and his wife Eurydice. She steps on a serpent and Orpheus goes down and he's, you know, plays the lyre or the harp to melt the hearts of actually Persephone and the god of the dead, whose name you're not supposed to say. Anyway, and they say, okay, well, you can have her come back with you, but you can't look back. Don't look back. And actually that story, that pattern is found around the world in the Americas, the American Native American nations across North America from coast to coast have versions of that exact, they called it the Orpheus myth. Europeans, when they first arrived, even in the 1600s, noticed it and said, oh, this is the Orpheus myth, which is obviously culturally, you know, patronizing, saying, oh, they have a version of our myth. Actually, the Native American versions have more, they preserve more details of the story, which are celestial details, than the Orpheus the Orpheus story. So maybe we should call the Orpheus story, you know, the version of this pattern that we see in the Americas. But anyway, this system is already in place in ancient Mesopotamia, ancient Egypt, ancient India, the Vedas, ancient China, ancient Japan, and the Americas. You know, Graham Hancock has written a book called America Before, where he finds some evidence to argue that maybe the first civilization was in the Americas, maybe in South America, where the Amazon is today.
That's a great book. I didn't read the whole thing. I got that one from the library, and it was, I don't know, what, 1,000 pages? Yeah. So I spent my time with it and then returned it once they said I had to get it back. So, but yeah.
I went on this big, long thing. Sorry, Deborah, didn't mean to cut you off, but I'm just trying to answer your question. It's clear to me that this system is more ancient than the most ancient cultures that we know of. So what happened to it? I think there was probably some kind of a cataclysm, a worldwide cataclysm before Egypt. And so probably even those most ancient cultures just had pieces of it and understood who knows how much of it. And maybe different pieces were preserved in different places. But then I think a second to your question, you said, well, was it, you know, literalist Christianity? Was it Judaism? Was, you know, there was, I think, also there a lot of evidence for a second problem, a second cataclysm, if you will, during the Roman Empire, when, with the rise of literalist Christianity, stamping out whatever remnants was left. You know, the ancient Greek and Roman gods were actually, you know, still being worshipped, and then they were, you know, they still had the oracle at Delphi going strong, and they had these mystery religions like the Eleusinian mysteries, mystery cults or mystery rituals. They had the Vestal Virgins, and when the Emperor Theodosius, who was a couple emperors after Constantine, who was the one who really first imposed it, then they outlawed, quote, paganism. They shut down the Oracle at Delphi. They shut down the Eleusinian mysteries. They and they started going around stamping out any ancient, you know, traditions of other nations, like, you know, the other European, there were Germanic and also Celtic and Druidic, and they didn't really get up to Norway and Iceland until the 1200s. But from about 400 AD onward, this literalist interpretation of Christianity, particularly in the Western church, of course, the church, you know, the Christian church split in half. And, you know, the question of Judaism is a very interesting one. I know that you have, you know, some interest in that as well. And, you know, I'll try and answer all this as best as I can. But this literalist kind of empire building, nation devouring system,
yeah,
went around and basically started devouring all the nations. By nations, I mean like the peoples and their inherited, like no Europeans were originally Christian. No Europeans were originally Christian. My grandfather came from Norway. You know, if you go back 1,000 years, they were worshiping Thor and Odin. Yeah. And by the time the 1200s, it was pretty much stamped out, even all the way up in the farthest north. And then they started building ships to go over to the Americas in, you know, the 1400s and 1500s, and stamping out whatever they could find over there.
Yeah, it's like they wanted to pave over everything. They wanted to pave over everything and make everyone Abrahamic, you know, put it into these couple of major religions and snuff out everything else. That would make sense to me, to where that's where things start becoming more literal. You know, especially if prior to that, you brought up Graham Hancock there briefly. You know, he's got his famous line of that we're a species with amnesia. Yeah. Maybe prior to that time, there was some understanding of that these were, all these stories were connected to all these myths were connected to the stars, to the sky. But by the time we started really taking things down and saying we can only have these few religions, or maybe whoever's saying it is saying we can only be Christian or Muslim or whatever, you know, seems like that would be a time where that amnesia would really kind of settle in and be like, okay, we're going to forget where these things come from and start taking literal interpretations.
Yeah, I love that line that you quoted, we're a species with amnesia, and I would actually amplify it. And I'm sure Graham would probably agree with me, at least up to a point. You know, I'm not suggesting or implying that he agrees with everything, sure. But he is quite familiar with my work. I've met him, you know, a few times. That's and great. I would amplify it and say, we're a species with trauma-induced amnesia. You know, and he talks about a great cataclysm. You know, Randall Carlson also, you know, the comet impact. Robert Schock talks about potentially a solar flare. So that's the first trauma of that. That's probably how we got disconnected from the origination of this system.
And is then, that the Younger Dryas?
Yeah, Younger Dryas impact.
10,000 BC time-ish.
What's that? Younger Dryas?
Yeah,
the Younger Dryas was a cataclysmic event that happened approximately 10,000 BC. That would have been huge. It would have been like the end of the Ice Age, is the way a lot of people look at it. Randall Carlson,
kind of cataclysm.
Yeah, Randall Carlson thinks it was like a comet or asteroid that hit like in Greenland and caused massive flooding, creating the scab lands of Washington and all of that. Other people, Robert Schock, who does all the water erosion work on the Sphinx enclosure, he believes that it could have been a solar flare or a series of solar flares. That gets into that. There's just different ways.
Randall says it could have been both. You could have, you know, whatever the mm-hmm. comet was that impacted could have also looped around the sun and caused, or, you know, its journey into this part of the solar system could have caused, but whatever it is, I don't really get too caught up with the details because it's not my particular area of expertise, but I think it's quite clear that we had a cataclysm, some kind of an actual physical cataclysm, predating Egypt, predating Mesopotamia, and those cultures, they have this system fully developed. Egypt already has it in its myths. Mesopotamia already has it in its myths. So it came from something before them and probably way before them. And they were separated from that by some cataclysm, physical cataclysm that might have been so bad that it caused people to have to live underground for maybe some generations. Like if Robert Schock has talked about the solar flare could have made the Earth's surface radioactive to where people, and you have these underground cities in Turkey, like multi-layered kind of carved into the limestone, like cave.
Capable of holding cities worth of people.
Massive, massive, massive. And so maybe when the, you know, people re-emerged, now they were separated from one another and the pieces started to diverge, or maybe while they were underground, the pieces diverged. I don't know for sure. We're kind of, you know, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves. Like I'll show you the evidence and then maybe we could return to that kind of speculation as to what happened. But the trauma, the reason I said trauma-induced amnesia is, it's pretty clear to me that the ancients, pre, you know, arrival of literalist Christianity, didn't have this kind of intolerant literalistic. If you look at the Greek myths, for instance, Achilles, you know, most of us know about the Achilles heel, or why we have an Achilles tendon is because Achilles was dipped, you know, by his mother holding that part of his heel into what? What was he dipped into? Do you guys know?
Fire. Fire.
Fire. But also in some versions, the river Styx. So in most versions, most ancient versions, it is fire. And the father, who's a mortal, it's his mother is a nymph or a goddess, and she's immortal and she wants to make him immortal. And so she dips him into, in one case, it's the river Styx, but in most cases, it's fire. And the husband, who's mortal, is horrified and he's like, don't do that. But in any event, the part where she holds is still vulnerable, and that's why he, you know, gets wounded in the, he doesn't make it through the Trojan War because of that one place where she was holding. But we don't have any evidence of massive ancient religious wars between the Achilles was dipped in water group and the Achilles was dipped in fire group. I use that as kind of a, like a little example that these myths have all kinds of variations. And you'll find one ancient author saying this and another ancient author saying that. And there's no evidence that anyone was at each other's throat over, you know, which version was the right version, because these were esoteric stories. And Plato, like I said, in one of his dialogues actually hints at that. And so just to close the loop on this trauma thing, we can return to it again also later. Why I say trauma-induced amnesia is I'm convinced that these stories are about healing trauma, or that's one of their central purposes. And it's interesting that psychologists, you know, like Freud obviously went to the myths to label the Oedipus complex or the, you know, Antigone or whatever. And because these stories are about healing trauma. But if you take them literally, what happens is you can actually invert their message. You can turn it from an esoteric message into an external message of, well, you know, this group accepts Jesus and that group doesn't, so they're wrong. And or this group is descended from, you know, this figure in the myths. Well, it's not a literal figure. It's an esoteric figure. It's a metaphorical figure. So nobody's descended from one or the other. But when we externalize them, there's all kinds of errors and inversions that can creep in to actually turn the message on his head and actually to traumatize. And we can see that, you know, there are doctrines that are traumatic doctrines, like, well, Eve sinned first, so therefore women can't teach, or therefore the man is always over the woman, or, you know, these are literalistic interpretations of esoteric metaphorical stories that are misinterpretations, that are inverted, that are actually inverting the message, or, you know, original sin. That is a trauma inducing doctrine. You're going to go to eternal hellfire and sulfur and brimstone if you don't X, Y, or Z. That's a traumatic type of approach. It's not a trauma healing approach. That's a trauma inducing approach. So I would argue we've had a second catastrophe where the beneficial trauma healing purpose has been inverted or subverted.
Yeah.
So is it to, go ahead.
Is it to keep people controlled?
I would
is that,
say
is that the basic purpose of you know, yeah, all this fear induced?
From my perspective, yeah. 100%.
I would say that there are people, you know, when I say that the Bible is based on the stars, sometimes people say, oh, are you trying to tell me it's not true? No, I'm not saying it's not true at all. I'm saying it's not literal. It's full of truth and beauty, and people are attracted to the Bible or to Buddhism or to Hinduism, all these, you know, sacred traditions and sacred that are built on sacred stories. And they can be just as literalistic. By the way, you can have a literalistic Buddhist or literalistic Hindu, which I think is mistaken and risks running into the same kinds of inversions, potential problems. But I would say that they are beneficial. And so I'm kind of careful to try and be nuanced about it. I think there are people who are following these ancient scriptures, are trying to base their life on these ancient scriptures because the scriptures are beautiful and it speaks to them, and they do contain truth and beauty that is actually beneficial to our life. But when you realize that they're esoteric, you don't lose any of the good parts, but you do lose the bad parts, in my opinion, the parts that are wrong to begin with because they're inversions. Like, You know, your grandmother went to hell, you better convert. You know, going over to Mongolia and telling people all your ancestors up till now are burning in hell and they just wish that we'd have gotten here sooner is not right. And once you understand that they're not literal, you can easily jettison that part, but still all the truth and beauty in there is still there.
Yeah. So what especially, I'm saying is there's
some people are I think honestly following it, but I do think if Robert Taylor showed this stuff in the 1830s, like that's an awful long time ago. We're coming up on 200 years. It's not just, look, it's a fact that the scriptures are based on the stars. Like, I'll just show you a few examples. I am not in any doubt, you know, whether I convince someone else or not, I am in absolutely no doubt that the evidence is overwhelming. So it's not possible that everyone is just missing this. There's some people who are suppressing this knowledge. There's no way, you know, Robert Taylor wrote about it in great detail and others have too. There's just no way to not see it. That's actually why I think the scriptures were not allowed to be translated into the common languages for a long time. You know, in Europe, it was considered a death penalty offense to translate the scriptures into the vulgar, the quote unquote vulgar, which means of the people languages. The first people who tried to translate it into English got executed in horrible ways. And it was the same for French or whatever. So why? Because if you look at it long enough and you know the stars, you'll see it yourself. You'll see it yourself.
Well, let's do that. Why don't we open up the screen share and start looking at some visuals here. Yeah. This would be a good time for anybody listening to maybe try and switch over to YouTube and take a look at it, because this should get pretty interesting.
Yeah, thanks. I will pull up a few. I chose a few. Look, I've got, you know, podcast archive that everyone can go see others. You know, I try and mix it up so that I do different ones all the time. But I thought, you know, since Deborah's here, I want to choose the ones that might be the most
clearest. I believe way. That you were on Tinfoil Hat with Sam Tripoli at one point, and that was one of the only episodes of that. I listened to it, and then I went back and watched it. It was a long time ago. It was on YouTube at that time. And because I just had to see what you were talking about, and it was absolutely mind-blowing.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. Yeah, Sam's always a super fun show. I've been on his main Tinfoil Hat a couple times, and then also he has Zero. I think he has another. It's on Rockfin only. That's called Zero, which is diving into spiritual things. It has to do with, you know, you come into the world with zero and you leave with zero. So what's it all about? Thanks for inviting me on. I know you mentioned a couple, you know, podcasts that I've been on that you watch, and I'm always really excited to share with new listeners and also new podcast hosts and teams who will ask, you know, from different perspectives. We all have different experience and different interests and different gifts and backgrounds and educational focuses. So you guys might ask some questions that nobody else asks. Mm-hmm. So let me just show you. I thought about what should I show and what's the best way to kind of introduce this to Deborah. And I decided to start just briefly with the first one that really started scratching my head. And I'm going to change. This chair is kind of squeaking a little bit. I want to be under the nice, quiet sky of the heavens here. Okay. So you can see I've got an image from Stellarium there on your screen. Can you see it okay? Adam, can you see it?
Yeah.
Deborah, you can see it? Great. Yeah, okay. Great. So the first one, and I, like I said, I was taking the Bible literally. I was going to church every Sunday. I even taught Sunday school classes sometimes. And also I was doing a Bible study, and this Bible study was going through the book of Judges, which is, you know, in the Hebrew scripture, the Old Testament. And at the time I was going through the book of Judges and we were studying Samson, I was reading this book, Hamlet's Mill. And the reason I started reading Hamlet's Mill was because of Graham Hancock mentioning it in a book. He's mentioned it in a few books. This has been a very seminal book for a lot of people, myself included. It was published in 1969 by two professors who were already pretty advanced in years. I mean, they'd been professors for decades, and they've long since passed away. Giorgio de Santayana and Herta von Decken from MIT. I don't know what other colleges they taught at, but they were looking at the evidence for some ancient worldwide system that included myths being connected to stars. They actually do kind of a confusing job of discussing this subject. But in this book, one thing, I was very fascinated by it because I always loved the myths. I always loved the stars growing up. I never put the two together, but when they started talking about the myths, you know, being based on the stars, and they talk about Samson, I was happy to see other myths based on the stars. Whenever they would talk about biblical characters, I would be like, oh, no, they got that wrong. Obviously, Samson was a literal person, you know, he was strongest man ever. But they talk about Samson and they say Sunday school students must have long puzzled, or children must have long puzzled over his choice of weapon for killing Philistines. Do you all know what his choice of weapon was for slaying Philistines? Anyone ever?
Wasn't a stone, was it?
No, it was a jawbone, actually. Oh. Have you heard of the jawbone of an ass, is how it's translated in the King James, or donkey, or an ass. Ass is actually slightly different from a donkey. But then they talk about, well, there's all these jawbones that are used as weapons in other cultures too. There's one in South America where it's the jawbone of a tapir, which is kind of a large pig-sized, you know, animal with almost a little elephant snout, not a full trunk, but, and then there's a story from the Pacific, New Zealand and other islands of the Pacific, where Maui uses a jawbone of his own grandmother to beat the sunbird into submission. So what's going on here? What's with all these jawbone weapons? And they say, I'll take the book cover away so that we can see the sky. They say, well, that jawbone is actually in the heavens. And so this is actually their interpretation, what I'm showing you here. They say, you see, the jawbone is in the sky, because actually in the story, he kills 1,000 Philistines with this jawbone. Now, just think about if that's literally true. Samson, very strong, is attacked by Philistines and then grabs a jawbone and starts slaying Philistines and kills 1,000 of them. And I always say that is just not practical to kill 1,000. Maybe the first or one or two, but that bone would probably wear out, first of all. And second of all, it's probably after you've killed a couple or three, you can grab one of their swords. Right? You don't need to keep using the jawbone. And it also, if you read the text, it says he put out his hand and took the jawbone of an ass. And it's like, why did it say he put out his hand? Why did it say he reached out his hand? Like, are we going to be confused and think that he might have picked up the jawbone with his foot or with his teeth? What's it in there for? Well, these are celestial markers actually pointing you, according to the authors of Hamlet's Mill. I'll show you their location of the jawbone. So this is the constellation that most people actually know. Can you see it?
Yeah.
On the screen, I've outlined it. It's got a belt of three stars. Can you see the belt of three stars? I didn't draw a line through the belt just so everyone could see it. That's who has the famous three-star belt in the sky?
I am.
Orion?
Orion, yes. So Orion is actually located right next to the constellation Taurus, Taurus the bull. Taurus is a zodiac constellation. Orion is not, but Taurus is. So some people are born, you know, in the sign of Taurus, means the sun has the background stars of Taurus at the time. That would be your sun sign. But the constellation Taurus is actually right above and on our screen to the right of Orion. You can see it. Can you see the kind of the Taurus looking, the bowl looking thing there? Yeah, that's the, this is the outlining system of HA Ray, which I love, and it's extremely helpful. Anyone know who H.A. Ray is? You guys might have heard me on other podcasts. Deborah, do you know who H.A. Ray is?
No, I don't.
H.A. Ray and his wife.
I've picked up these books.
Yeah, yeah. H.A. Ray and his wife are famous authors, actually. They're famous authors who wrote a series of children's books called Curious George. H.A. Ray and his wife created Curious George, but H.A. Ray also wrote this book called The Stars, A New Way to See Them. So these outlines that I have on the screen are from H.A. Ray's outlining system, and it's actually way better for A, finding the stars in the night sky, but also B, for seeing the connections between the ancient myths. And to my knowledge, H.A. Ray never said or wrote, I'm giving you this system that you know, you can use this system to connect to the ancient myths. But the system that he lays out is so, it's phenomenal. You can find ancient artwork that it is clearly using his system. Well, if he published it in 1952, how is an ancient Greek vase from, you know, 450 BC using his outlining system? I don't know how he got this outlining system, but this is the outlining system that helps you see the connections. Maybe he got it in a vision. Maybe it was part of some preserved tradition that he decided in 1952 to publish, because you may know that H.A. Ray escaped from Paris, you know, when he and his wife escaped from Paris when the Nazis were coming in. So the, and they fled to South America and then ended up in Greenwich Village, New York. But, you know, maybe after that tremendous cataclysm of World War II, he said, hey, I need to publish this. I don't know what the story is, but in 1952, he published this outlining system, and it's extremely useful. But I went off on that little tangent because I'm going to show you a different outlining of Taurus than he does here. This is the way I like to find it in the sky. This part of Taurus that I just outlined, that V shape, can you see that V shape that I just put?
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a group of stars called the Hyades. It's an ancient Greek, there's a myth associated with it, but it's this distinctive V shape, and it's in the bull. It's in the constellation of the bull. And you may be familiar with another star cluster nearby. I'm going to circle right here. That would be the beautiful cluster of the Pleiades. The Pleiades. Have you heard of the Pleiades? They're really dazzling. Mostly you see them in the winter time, like around October, they start rising in the east after darkness. Orion's up in the Northern Hemisphere's winter, the months that are winter for us. And by the way, I'm from the Bay Area. I don't know, Deborah, if you grew up in the Bay Area. Or...
I did.
Okay, great. In the city or on the peninsula?
In the East Bay.
East Bay, right on. Yeah, I grew up in San Mateo. My dad grew up in San Francisco. He went to Lincoln High in San Francisco. So
yeah.
And my parents and sister still live up there. But I live down Central Coast now. But anyway, not to get off track, I did want to mention that. We see this mostly in the winter, this lineup of stars here. It's the Southern Hemisphere summer when it's our winter. But anyway, that V-shaped Hyades, that's what the authors of Hamlet's Mill say, that's the jawbone. See how it looks like a jawbone? Like if you trace your jaw line underneath your chin, you can feel the bone is actually a V. If you ever see, you know, you can go online and find jawbone of a horse. Just look it up and look for pictures of what they look like. They're a very narrow V, just like that. But Samson doesn't use the jawbone of a bull. He uses the jawbone of an ass. So what's going on? I'll explain. But from the tips of that jawbone, you can actually draw two lines to these two stars. That's the way I envision Taurus in the sky. It's like one of the few places I differ from H.A. Ray. But can you see how those look like two long horns kind of mm-hmm. extended out from the jawbone? But those could also be the long, what does an ass have that's long instead of ears. Horns? Long ears. And there are myths of, you know, kings who get ass ears, like King Midas, which is actually this very same part of the sky. Or there's a myth we'll talk about where there's a famous figure in the Hebrew scriptures, again, in the book of Numbers, who is riding on an ass, and the ass talks to him. So what's going on? This is the jawbone of the bull, or in Taurus, could also be the jawbone of an ass if you just envision the horns as long ears instead of long horns. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And so now you can see how Orion, who's this powerful looking figure, could be envisioned as reaching out to grab that jawbone. So that is what the authors of Hamlet's Mill argue. Ah, this is what that story is about. It doesn't make much sense literally, but if you understand that that jawbone is actually in the sky, and Samson is probably a figure who's associated with Orion, then that starts to make sense. So that's about as far as they go on that. And they give a few other examples, but the book itself is kind of confusing. Partly, I'm convinced, because they didn't use the outlining system of H.A. Rey. So they don't see all the connections. When you use the outlining system of H.A. Rey, you can really start to see the characteristics of these constellations. But let me just quickly, I'll pause and let you ask some questions in a minute, but I just want to connect to that other story of the figure who rides on a donkey. We'll say a donkey, but in the King James, they translate it as an ass. And for generations, this story was known as the story of Balaam's ass, or Balaam and the ass. And of course, we don't say that anymore because, you know, everyone would just laugh about Balaam's ass. But he's riding on a donkey. And so there's this figure right above Taurus. There's a different figure. This is the figure of Perseus. Perseus, you see how it's right above the Hyades? It's a little ways away, but if you were writing stories or myths and they do this, you could sometimes say, well, let's have a figure who's a Perseus, associated with Perseus, but who's going to be riding on a donkey. And there are figures in ancient Greek myth who ride on a donkey also. We'll bring him up in a second. But has anyone ever heard the story of Balaam and the ass? Mm. Adam or?
No.
Okay. Well, it's in Numbers chapter 22. And the Moabites, you know, there's a place in Utah called Moab because, you know, people like to name places after biblical stories, especially in Utah. But Moab, the Moabites were nervous about the Israelites coming up out of Egypt. They'd heard the story of the Exodus, and then they'd heard the story of Jericho, what happened there. And the Moabites started getting really nervous. And the king of Moab, whose name was Balak, this is in Numbers 22, said, I better call the most holy man I know, or the most, you know, the shaman or the guy who's connected to the divine realm, whose name is Balaam. I better send him some messengers and some gifts and have him curse the Israelites so that they won't take us down the way they took down the Amorites. Actually, it was just after the Israelites defeated the Amorites. And so the king of Moab gets nervous and he calls Balaam and he sends some messengers out to Balaam and says, hey, Balaam, King Balak wants you to curse these people that are heading our way. And Balaam says, okay, let me consult with the Almighty before I do anything. I consult with the Almighty. And so he does. And the Almighty says, don't curse them. You're not allowed to curse them. You better not. And so the next morning he wakes up, he says to the messengers, sorry, no dice, take your gifts and go away. I'm not going to curse them because the Almighty says not to. And so they go back to the king and they say, hey, he said no. And the king says, okay, I'll send some even more prestigious messengers with even better gifts to Balaam. And Balaam, you know, tells him the same thing. Hey, no. But then the Almighty says to Balaam, actually, you can go with them. Just don't curse those people. Those people are not to be cursed. They're mine, my special people that you will not curse. And Balaam says, okay, I'll go with them. Then the next verse or the next chapter says, so Balaam went with them and God was angry because Balaam went with them. And it's a little confusing because it's like, wait a minute, he just said to go with them. But in the story, Balaam is riding on his donkey. He's going to, he's not going to curse the Israelites because he was told not to. And he said very clearly, I only, you know, as a holy man, I only do what God tells me to do. But he's going with them. And all of a sudden his donkey stops. And you can read all about the whole story. I'll just give you the summary. The donkey stops in the path and Balaam starts to beat the donkey. He's like, go. And the donkey won't go. And the more he beats the donkey, the more the donkey won't go. And then the donkey crushes his foot between, as they're on the path to the vineyard, it says, the donkey crushes his foot between the walls and his foot gets twisted and he's really mad and he beats the donkey even harder. And it's a she ass, you know, the text says she every time the donkey speaks. She says to Balaam, why are you beating me? Haven't I served you all these years and never complained, and now you're beating me? And Balaam, this is in the Bible, this is, you know, you don't hear this in Sunday school too often because, well, we have a donkey turning around and talking to Balaam, and Balaam doesn't think anything is strange about it. He starts talking right back to the donkey and says, well, because you won't go three times, you know, and now you crush my foot. And the donkey says, well, there's an angel in the way, and the angel has a drawn sword. And if I kept going, the angel would have killed you. And the angel says, yeah, why are you beating your donkey? She saved your life. I was going to cut your head off. Here's a picture of Balaam and the ass. You can see the angel. So there we have the donkey. The donkey is like, ah, come on, stop oppressing me. And Balaam's like, go. And he's in between the wall. You can see the wall there off to the left. I guess his foot has been crushed. Now, can you see, look up at Perseus. You see the outline of Perseus? That's the H.A. Ray outline. Very helpful for finding it in the sky. If you go look on Wikipedia, you'll probably get a terrible, useless outline of Perseus that won't help you find it in the sky at all. But that's, Perseus has all these different characteristics. But one distinctive characteristic, can you see how it plays into the story? Is there anything about that outline that?
The stick?
Holding the bat?
Yeah, it does look like he's holding a long stick or a bat. One hand is kind of curled around, so that could be envisioned as like a little whip or like a little, you know, like cat of, like a little thrash or little knotted cords or something. But there's something about,
remember, is he wearing a hat?
Yeah, he's wearing an interesting hat. So King Midas wears that same kind of hat, and Midas is the king who gets ass's ears in the Greek myths. So the Phrygian cap comes from this constellation, the specific cap. It's like the Liberty cap. It's got long ear flaps. Mm-hmm. But in the story, the donkey, what does she do that makes him really mad?
Breaks his foot.
She crushes his foot. Can you see anything about his foot?
Yeah,
sure.
Does it look twisted to you at all? Like going the wrong way? And there's actually a Greek god who rides on a donkey because his legs got broken when he was thrown down from Olympus by either his mother Hera or his father Zeus, one or the other. Anyone know the story of Hephaestus?
God
of fire, that's right.
Okay.
His name in Latin is Vulcan.
Okay.
Vulcan, mm-hmm. The god Vulcan, from which we get volcano. So he's the god of the smiths, like of, you know, hammering at the forge. But
not Morrissey. He was
thrown down from the heavens. Pardon?
Not Morrissey. Not that Smiths.
Oh, yeah. The Smiths from the Morrissey from the Smiths. Yeah. He's the god of the Smiths.
Sorry.
What generation are you, Adam?
I'm 42, so I'm
you're
like,
too young
like,
to know about Morrissey. And yeah.
he reads a lot.
Yeah.
I listened to one of your episodes, and Deborah was like, reading off all the members of the band Cream. I was like, man, that's my I love that generation. Yeah, Disraeli Gears. I used to have that album on vinyl, actually. But anyway, sorry about the tangent. That's Adam's fault. But look at how the foot is twisted. Can you see that? And it's in the myth. And mm-hmm. so in the Greek myths, the reason why Hephaestus or Hephaestus or Vulcan is lame in both feet is because his parents threw him down from Olympus. But because he's associated with that constellation, you can see how Perseus in some stories, you know, has his foot twisted or his foot broken. And that's why Hephaestus has to ride on a donkey. And you can see again, riding on a donkey, twisted foot. So that's a parallel actually between a Greek myth and this story from Numbers. But where's the angel? Where could the angel be that's blocking Balaam and his donkey from going forward to the vineyard? I'll show it to you. It's a little hard, but right there is a beautiful constellation known as Andromeda. That's Andromeda. And Andromeda is, sometimes she's a beautiful princess in the Greek myths, but that constellation sometimes plays an angelic figure, actually. And you can see, in this case, she's like splayed out with her feet pointing towards Perseus. But in some myths, actually, I think that arching leg, the upper leg, becomes like an angel wing, or is envisioned as an angel wing, and she's like reaching out towards Perseus. And I can show that in other artwork. But you can see that this artwork, you've got Balaam above the donkey, and then the angel, like they're in the right positions. Mm-hmm. It doesn't prove anything. You know, this is artwork from, I think, the 1700s. It doesn't prove anything about the ancient scriptures, but it's very interesting how artwork will reflect heavenly patterns. It's like this system is somehow preserved in artwork. We could get into that too, but there's also a vineyard mentioned in the text. It's on the road to the vineyard that the donkey starts talking to Balaam when Balaam is beating the donkey. And the vineyard is going to be harder to see because on this stellarium image, they don't outline it the right way. But there's, to the right of Andromeda, can you see how Andromeda is kind of blocking Perseus?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's the angel that's blocking Perseus. And just trust me that Andromeda plays an angel in some other myths. I've shown some evidence in some other places about it. But on the way to the vineyard, if you look to the right of Andromeda, can you see what I'm going to outline? A little bit of this constellation, but can you see anything over there to the right of Andromeda? Any guesses as to what constellation that could be?
No. Looks wild, but I have no idea. Wild.
It's actually a horse figure. You see that, how it's like a horse?
Now
it's,
oh yeah, yeah, now I there see it, go. Yeah.
But there's something on the back of the horse, or actually attached like to the back hip of the horse, like on the rump of the horse there. There's like a triangle.
Okay.
Can you see that triangle? That's a wing. That's because that's Pegasus. That's the constellation is Pegasus, but the back of Pegasus, there's this, actually it's a square. If you include Andromeda's head, the star for Andromeda's head, that's actually called the Great Square of Pegasus. And the Great Square plays the role of a vineyard in many different myths, including in the myth where Noah gets drunk. You know, Noah plants the first vineyard, then he gets drunk. And that's the story of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And why Ham got cursed is because he like called attention to his father's nakedness when he was drunk after planting the first vineyard. Well, in this story, it's very clear that Balaam is on the way to the vineyard when he's blocked by the angel. So look, there's the great square. Can you see how it's a vineyard? Maybe not. I mean, it's just a square. But these ancient myths, they sometimes it'll be a walled city. Sometimes it'll be a vineyard. Sometimes it'll be the horse getting its skin pulled off of it. There's lots of
interpretations.
Yeah, there's a myth from Japan where the horse gets flayed, you know, gets its skin pulled off. And it's in the Kojiki of ancient Japan. It's a backward flayed horse. And you can see why that's, you know, that square is like the skin of the horse. But in this case, it's playing the role of a vineyard. And so the angel is blocking Balaam from the vineyard. And you can see it right there in the sky. And it relates to these other myths that, you know, we've mentioned about, like Vulcan or Hephaestus, or in the Kojiki, it's a god named Susanoo, who is the sun, or no, anyways, related to the sun goddess. He angers the sun goddess by throwing this backward flayed horse down among her among her maidens who are weaving in the weaving hall, which is also a common weaving is found in all kinds of myths. It's all over in the Odyssey. But let me just pause there and see kind of what like reaction or response. I've got some more to show too. But does this make any sense, or does it seem really far-fetched?
Well, I can see how, you know, people, ancient times, looking up in the sky and, you know, using the stars to make sense of their world.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like what I would say at this point is, like, it all makes sense if I am to understand that they were, that these ancient peoples were taught a system of stars, like we're shown these outlines to look at, to then reflect upon, you know, which would go to the amnesia concept, that the, mm-hmm. there were others before them who had outlines that, you know, H.A. Ray either knew about or channeled, or, you know, came to him in a dream, or however he got to that, but something along those lines, maybe not identical to him, but something that, you know, would be passed around from culture to culture, of them seeing these things in the same way. So that, like, the great square, I don't think I would ever see that square just looking at the stars myself. You know what I mean? Or if I saw the square, I'm not going to see Andromeda, you know, like I'm not going to draw these same things. But to know that multiple cultures from multiple regions were seeing that and interpreting these things in similar ways, like it all starts to unfold to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, it's a great point, because, you know, Deborah, you said, well, it makes sense for them to look up in the heavens and try and make sense of their world down here. But we would really expect every culture to see them very differently, because some of these are very obscure.
Yeah.
Some of them are more obvious than others. Some are very obvious, but some are pretty obscure. But for the Hyades to be, you know, a donkey's jawbone across many cultures, that's asking too much of coincidence. Or, you know, for, you know, Perseus to always have twisted feet, you know, that would imply that everyone has to outline it pretty much this way. And are really the Greeks outlined it the same way as, you know, so this probably did come from some unified source, some common source in some way.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, go ahead.
Aaron. So are you saying that there was some sort of, we're really into speculation on this show, so speculate away if you want to. I've been wanting to ask about collective consciousness as far as this goes. What do you think about that?
Yeah, that's a possible explanation. You know, the fact is we don't know, you know, how this system is around the world the same way. But collective unconscious is a possible explanation. As we know, you know, Carl Jung, you know, posited the collective unconscious because we've got these stories, that these patterns that keep emerging, you know. Now, I could have said to Jung, well, that's of course because they're all based on the same star system. You know, you don't have to have a collective unconscious if you have some very ancient culture that had a cataclysm and then the pieces were continued in all these different cultures around the world. We don't have to explain it with a collective unconscious, but it could be that the collective unconscious. Another thing is, it could be that when you go into trance or altered non-ordinary
DMT.
DMT or ayahuasca. First of all, where did H.A. Rey and his wife escape to? He was in Rio before World War II, Rio de Janeiro, and he was selling like bathtub fixtures and sinks and stuff in Brazil. So he's in the Amazon basin, which is where you have ayahuasca.
Sure.
And they escaped over to South America again and made their way back to Greenwich Village. Is that how I think the story went? Maybe he went into an ayahuasca. I mean, it's fascinating to speculate. Maybe when you go into these altered states, there's a unified system that can be presented. Maybe the plants all know this system because they look at the, the heavenly cycles.
And they're under the same sky.
Yeah. I mean, they need to know the stars better than we do. It could be from a lot of different possibilities.
Yeah.
And
they,
I don't know.
Only use like, 10% of our brain. You know, we have access to 10% of it, maybe at one point in time. You know, before we had all these distractions, maybe we had more access to some of that stuff and, you know, we could have communicated it in who knows how.
Maybe we had talking, Deborah.
Maybe we had ESP.
Deborah, you missed that. You missed their episode with Jared Murphy where he discussed that exact idea. Yeah. Well, you know what's most interesting to me is that, like, if it was a collective consciousness kind of concept, I think that more than one culture could look at the sky and find a V shape and say that it's a jawbone or a square and say that it's a vineyard or something to that effect. But I feel like I could look at the sky and find plenty of V shapes, triangles, squares that aren't in the same spot. But the idea that these come in the same spot tells me that it's either knowledge that's being passed down, although I can't believe I've never entertained the idea of like a meditative or a state of mind, a trance that you could maybe dial in. And suddenly these things that we're looking at, these not even necessarily with the outlines, but these stars might come out to us more. And then we start drawing lines between the stars that seem more important or something to that effect.
Yeah, who knows? It's really interesting. But you know, you could say, well maybe the Balaam story, you know, really literally happened and you're just kind of seeing it in the sky. But there's, I actually stopped a little short because in the story he also builds, eventually, you know, God says, well, why don't you bless them instead of cursing them? Which blessing versus cursing is a really important pattern throughout around the world. Like you should bless and not curse. You should. And actually it's really interesting about the 10% of the brain. I just recently saw a video. I think my wife showed it to me of someone saying, actually, when you're in the real like flow state, really in touch with your higher self, you think you're using more of your brain or less of your brain. It turns out you're shutting off some of the, you know, some of the the non-essential. Like when you're really in a sport situation or a surfing, you know, you're really just dialed in, or maybe musical, you're just really dialed in with the rest of your band members. Actually, parts of your brain that are the doubting parts and the you know, self-critical parts are shutting down, and you're just getting stripped down to that, you know, that core of your brain that really knows things. But so blessing versus cursing, you know, like self-doubt and self-sabotage is part of this whole, we see doubting Thomas, or in the Bhagavad Gita, Arjun is filled with doubt. This idea of blessing versus cursing is very powerful. I'll just touch on it here. I don't want give a big long lecture, but he in the story sets up seven altars with fire, and he sacrifices on each altar a bull and a ram, or seven bulls and seven rams. Now what's really interesting, I circled the Pleiades there. They're in between Taurus the bull, or they're actually on Taurus, they're included as part of Taurus the bull. They're known as the seven sisters. But there's actually, you know, there's way more than seven. They're known as the seven sisters across many, many cultures. which is again another one of those coincidences. Like, how did they come up with seven? Because if you look at them with binos, it's way more than seven, or even with the naked eye. But in this story, it's seven fires and it's bulls and rams. Now, the Pleiades happen to be in between Taurus and another zodiac constellation that I just outlined for you there. And that is Aries. What's Aries?
Ram.
Aries is the ram. So in between the ram and the bull in the sky, you've got the seven sisters of the Pleiades, or the, you know, this dazzling, beautiful cluster. So in the story, there's seven fires with rams and bulls that Balaam sets up. So this isn't, look, this story came from this part of the sky. It's not me projecting a story. Oh, this is convenient. You know, let me force this story into some constellations. No, the clues are very abundant. And I could go on and on actually with, and I've got a little bit from Adam and Eve here to show you, like, some really, this one I consider to be a super convincing and easy to see. This is from Genesis, actually 3 is the part on the left. You can see chapter 4 starts there in the right-hand column on your screen. But this is the famous part where they're getting thrown out of the Garden of Eden. And I'm not going to do a whole long explication of the whole story, but it's all in the sky. Getting thrown out of the garden is actually getting thrown out of the paradise of the sky. As the stars rotate down, they sink down out of the sky, right? You can see it. They, you know, Adam comes from the dust. He says, "For dust thou art, and unto dust thou shalt return." Why did he come from the dust? Because he rose in the east. Why does he return to the dust? Because he sinks down in the west.
Oh, sure.
But there's this really, revealing passage right here. I'm just going to zero in on this. In Genesis 3:15, I will put enmity between thee and the woman. Has anyone ever heard this part? And between thy seed and her seed, it shall bruise thy head, and thou shalt bruise his heel. You guys ever heard that part before?
I'm half, but it hasn't necessarily meant too much.
Well, what happens is God, you know, throws them out of the garden, and each time he does, he pronounces, you know, a judgment. Like on the serpent, he says, from now on, you're going to crawl on your belly and eat dust, right? You can actually see it in the verse right above the one that I put a square around. See, upon thy belly shalt thou go, and dust shalt thou eat all the days of thy life. And then the woman, what's the judgment that he pronounces to the woman? Anyone remember?
Childbirth will be
yes.
painful.
Yes, it's actually the verse right after the one that is in sorrow thou shalt thou bring forth children. I'll greatly multiply thy sorrow and thy conception. It's going to be painful. Childbirth is going to be painful.
Yeah.
And I always jokingly say, come on, how hard, I mean, really, how hard could that be? I'm just kidding.
Hey, come on, we did a home birth here. It was no big deal.
I know, I'm joking. I passed out. Like, but her judgment has to do with childbirth. But the serpent, he has to go on his belly. But also, this verse 15, God says to the serpent, also, in addition to going on your belly and eating dust, I'm going to put enmity. I'm going to make you enemies. There's going to be a state of war between you and the woman. She's going to hate you, and your offspring are going to hate her offspring. But her offspring shall bruise thy head, but in turn, you shall bruise his heel. That's a very interesting passage. It's very specific, and I'm going to show you. I'm just going to bring in the stars here. Hopefully you can still see it in the upper right there, the inset on your screen. I'm going to outline the serpent here, or a serpent. There's a lot of serpents in the sky. There's a bunch. This is the constellation Hydra. It's a very long constellation. It just happens to be right underneath the constellation Virgo. So it's almost like sidling up right next to her to whisper in her ear, and then it's slithering off. So there's Virgo. Now look at Virgo. Does she look like she's going across the heavens? This is northern hemispheric, looking towards the south. She's obviously a zodiac constellation. She's going across the heavens on her back. You see that? With her legs elevated and spread apart, which obviously means she's what?
Giving birth.
giving birth or having sex. That's the other thing you can think of.
Sure.
And the myths aren't shy about that, by the way. There's, you know, myths where she's, the myths have all this bizarre or X-rated stuff in them because they're based on the stars. And so they sometimes Virgo is envisioned as having sex, but often she is envisioned as having children. And remember, her judgment in this story has to do with, I'm going to greatly multiply your pain in giving birth. So, and that's all, that's why there's so many virgin births, by the way. Virgo is, looks like she's giving birth, right? Now, who would she be giving birth to? I'm going to draw an arrow here. So this constellation right here is often one that she's giving birth to. It looks pretty big, but it's a big baby. That's why it's so multiplied, giving birth, so painful. That is a very important constellation. Not many people have heard of it, but it's called Ophiuchus. Maybe you've heard of it. Have you guys heard of it? It means the serpent holder. Can you see why it's the serpent holder?
It's like a central,
On both sides of serpent halves. You see the two serpent halves?
Yeah.
It's like a central kind of tombstone shape with feet. Like, you know, there's a rectangle and a triangle on top. Then there's a serpent on either side, like holding a serpent on either side, and then feet down below. So it's like a serpent holder. So that is the seed of the woman in this passage, I'm convinced. So the seed of the woman is going to crush the head of the seed of the serpent. So who's the offspring of the serpent? Who comes behind the serpent? There's another serpent right here. This one actually plays a serpent more than almost any other constellation. That's just part of it because it's still coming up, rising in the east in this particular snapshot. I'll show you the whole thing in a minute. That's actually the constellation Scorpio.
Mm-hmm.
So Scorpio actually does play a serpent or sometimes a worm. Like Jesus will say their worm does not turn, you know, in the fires. They're in the fires where their worm does not turn. That's Scorpio, is the worm that doesn't turn. So that is, can you see how Scorpio is a serpent that is like the offspring of the other serpent there, or the seed of the other serpent? It's like she gave birth to Ophiuchus, Hydra gave birth to Scorpio. Can you see that at all? Now, is one of them stepping on one of them's head and one of them look like he might be able to bite one of them's heel?
Yeah.
Can you see that? I'll put a little explosion kind of symbol there. Stepping on the head, biting the heel. Like the heel is right there. Like look, the heel, I'm gonna show you a little bigger. This is again, Ophiuchus. There's Ophiuchus. And then can you see Scorpio right down beneath the feet of Ophiuchus?
Yeah.
Ophiuchus, and I'm gonna actually draw Scorpio with multiple heads because sometimes Scorpio will play a multi-headed, you can see all the stars there. Like, you know, in the Greek myths of the Hydra with nine heads, we just saw a constellation named Hydra, but that's not the one that plays the Hydra that Hercules fights. It's, I'm certain, Scorpio with the multiple heads. Scorpio plays a multi-headed snake a lot. So you see how Ophiuchus is standing, crushing the head, but at the same time, Scorpio is in position to bite where on Ophiuchus specifically? The heel. And it says it right in the text. It's like you can't say, oh, Dave, you're just interpreting pictures from the 1500s. That's not convincing. I don't need pictures, but pictures are very, very helpful to show it. Pictures is really interesting how the pictures, this system got passed down somehow into the artwork, but it's in the text itself. It's in the story itself. I don't need the pictures to prove that this is based on the stars.
I wonder if that artwork, the pictures and stuff, just like H.A. Rey having these outlines, like I wonder, again, back to the collective unconscious or conscious and the, you know, the idea of finding these things through trance states and things like that.
Could be.
You know, I wonder if that's why it would appear, you know, thousands of years later in artwork of someone interpreting it. Maybe they weren't, as we discussed earlier, they're not looking at the sky to look at this anymore, but you know, a great painter paints a story from the Bible. And then when we look back at it, we go, oh man, they unconsciously made this line up with the stars because it's all there.
It's a really interesting possibility. The other possibility, of course, is that some kind of a system was passed down, and the artist didn't necessarily need to know well, this is based on the constellations. They could just be told conventions. You know, when you paint Mary, you're going to have her arm out all the time. And she's going to, you know, you've got to have her arm out. Why? Well, that's just how it's done. Because they did have art academies in Europe. And Mary is almost always depicted the way Virgo is, with an outstretched arm. I didn't actually show it because I wasn't going to go into that. But I'm going to show you. I'm going to finish my little presentation with one. Do you have time for one more? Or?
Yeah,
sure.
All right, real quick. This serpent holding constellation of Ophiuchus is super important. Super important. It's also right next to the Milky Way. Can you see the Milky Way there? I've outlined the Milky Way, but that's the Milky Way. Okay. The Milky Way plays a lot of different roles in different myths. Often the Milky Way will, I don't know, what would you guys just imagine? You're writing some myths. What would you use? If you want to incorporate the Milky Way, what might you metaphorically describe it as?
A road.
A road, yep. Could be a road. That's a good one.
Smoke or a cloud?
Yes, smoke or even fiery, you know, fiery pillar there, or pillar of fire, or smoky cloud, or, you know, fire from Sodom and Gomorrah getting burned up.
Maybe a scar.
A scar. Ooh, that's interesting. I don't know any myths that actually do have a scar, but there is that dark, we'll talk about that actual dark scar down the middle of the Milky Way. But it could also be, did someone say a river? I thought I might have heard
someone say. Yeah, the sea or the ocean. Or
sea, river, ocean, yes. A body of water too. So it could be, remember, Achilles got dipped in a fire or in a water, river. So I'm not going to show you the Achilles myth. I'm going to show you the crossing of the Red Sea with Moses.
Oh, sure.
So here we have again Ophiuchus. Remember, Ophiuchus is holding a serpent. But Ophiuchus figures will sometimes be envisioned as having a staff too. Can you see why he's like holding a staff or a rod? Especially the tail side of the serpent. But what's interesting about Moses' staff is, what can it turn into?
Snake.
The snake. He actually, that's one of the things in the story. He throws it down to prove that he actually was told by the Almighty what to do. You know, he throws it down in the presence of Pharaoh and it turns into a serpent. In fact, when he's doubting, there's a doubting Moses passage. He's been kicked out of Egypt or chased out of Egypt. He had to run for his life because he killed a man in Egypt and fled to the desert. He's all by himself. It even says he's in the backside, or, you know, the empty part of the desert. He encounters the burning bush and God gives him this mission. You're going to do this. You're going to go back to Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. And Moses immediately starts doubting and having all kinds of excuses why he's not the right, like, are you sure you picked the right Moses here? And God says, throw your staff down. I'll give you some signs to prove to Pharaoh that should convince him. Throw your staff down and it'll turn into a serpent. So here we have a figure in the heavens that has a staff, but it's a staff that could also be envisioned as a serpent or as a staff. Now, I just looked at the Milky Way. There's a very bright part of the Milky Way. In fact, Ophiuchus's foot is going right into the brightest part of the Milky Way. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
It's actually called the galactic center, the galactic core. By, you know, scientists believe that's the center of our galaxy. So when we're looking in this direction, that's the center of the Milky Way. But right above that, this dark scar, right? And you can actually see it. It's got a name. They call it the dark rift. And you can envision it almost as like a pathway across the Milky Way. Now, when they cross the Red Sea, I'm just super shortening. I do have a, you know, I've got a book where I talk about the star myths of the Bible that was published in 2016. I also have some online courses now where I'm going through the Bible. But like I said, this is all the myths. There are figures in other myths who have staffs or spears that are associated with Ophiuchus. Ophiuchus will often have a spear, sometimes two spears, and you could see why it would be two. Like in the Iliad, Hector fights with two spears, and sometimes there's a ring on top of one of the spears. Well, look at Ophiuchus. Can you see how there's like a ring on top of one side?
Sure.
Not a ring, it's the serpent's head, but you know, you can envision it in all these different ways and different myths. So sometimes it's a spear, sometimes it's a staff. But where is Ophiuchus holding his staff out towards in terms of the Milky Way? Like the dark rift, like right into, he's like placing the staff. When does God part the Red Sea for the children of Israel to cross? When Moses, he says, Moses, hold your rod out over the sea and I'll part the Red Sea. So there's Moses holding his rod out over the Red Sea, and there's a pathway across the Milky Way. That's the parting of the Red Sea, I would argue. And there's lots of other details in the story, like Pharaoh and all his chariots are coming after Moses, right? And they drown in the Red Sea. They don't get to the other side. So there's Ophiuchus. He's made it to the other side. He's leading the children of Israel to the other side, but Pharaoh and the horsemen are blocked. You see, they're running into the brightest part of the Milky Way there. You see, that's actually Sagittarius. Now, Sagittarius is, this is the outline of H.A. Rey. It doesn't look like a horse, but Sagittarius is associated with, like, have you guys ever seen any diagrams or drawings of Sagittarius? Like where it's a
few.
Like a centaur?
Mm-hmm.
So Sagittarius is associated with horses. Why? This is the brilliant outline of H.A. Rey, but it looks more like a woman wearing a long skirt holding a bow rather than a horse, right? And actually, Sagittarius does play beautiful women in the myths as well, or beautiful goddesses. There's goddesses who have bows too, like Diana or Artemis. She's associated, I'm convinced, with Sagittarius. But I'll show you how this could also be a centaur. If you look, there's a faint star down below kind of the waistband of that dress. I'm going to draw a line to it and then you'll see it. But if you look straight down, you see how her dress, I say her, all these constellations play male figures and female figures in different, they're very versatile, okay? But you see the dress or, you know, skirt, whatever, there's like a belt, kind of like a high-waisted belt there.
Yeah.
If you go straight down, if you just extend that line straight down, you'll see another star down there just kind of floating all by itself. I'm going to draw a line to it. See that?
Okay.
So now if you look at Sagittarius, you can imagine the skirt could become the body of a horse.
Uh-huh.
You see what I'm saying?
Oh,
sure. Yeah, yeah.
If you just add that one line, now we've got a horse, you know, we've got a horse with three legs, but let's just imagine that that line is the two front legs with a human torso coming out holding a bow. That's why Sagittarius is almost always depicted in like Sagittarius zodiac signs as a Taurus, a centaur with holding a bow. Anyway, that's Pharaoh and his horses and charioteers getting stuck in the, you know, the mud as the sea closes back over them. And actually there's even an actual verse that says the wheels came off their chariots and got, buried in the mud. And there's this little Southern crown. It's called the Southern crown right there. You could imagine that as a chariot wheel that's come off and is halfway buried in the mud. You see that?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's my, I'm not positive if that's what the verse is actually referring to, but then there's this whole song of Miriam, the sister of Moses, and they, you know, talking about the horse and his rider, you've thrown down into the sea, this whole passage, it's talking about the heavens. And you could even envision, remember how I said the multiple heads of Scorpio, you could, this is a stretch, this is Scorpio here, envision that as, Scorpio is coming out on the other side. So Sagittarius is the Egyptians getting left behind. This Scorpio could be all the many heads could be the children of Israel following after Moses. And you might say, well, that's a stretch, which it is a stretch. But I only say that because look at this artwork right here. This is from Foster's Bible, Illustrated Bible of the 1800s. But it's really interesting. If you look closely at the artwork, clearly you can see Moses. You can see kind of a pillar of smoke.
Yeah.
Now, imagine that pillar of smoke is the Milky Way. You see how Moses is in the right spot for Ophiuchus?
Yeah.
Holding out his staff, just like you see how the left side of Ophiuchus is holding out his staff.
Very even similar the, to bent knee.
See doing there?
The bent knee is similar.
Bent knee. And he's right next to the Milky Way, or right next to, in this case, the cloudy smoke. Now, where's the Sagittarius figure or the horse figure foundering in the mud to the left? Look down below his knee there, like his bent knee is pointing right down to some poor Egyptians with their...
Oh, right, yeah.
They're just falling down in the mud. Can you see him there?
Yeah.
That's right where Sagittarius is, on the other side of the smoke. You see that? Now let's look. Where's all the children of Israel who are coming up and rejoicing? Can you see how they're almost, they're in the exact angle of Scorpio. In this artist, there's even like the guy at the very bottom, an old man leaning on it. He's got like his bent knees there. It's like the stinger of Scorpio. And then up at the top, there's all the women with their arms in the air. Just like, you see how that looks like a Scorpio to the right of... Yeah. Can you see that in the artwork?
Mm-hmm.
It's like the artistic conventions. And this one's from the 1800s, but you can go back to the 1600s and find depictions of kind of this same pattern, just a little, you know, more 1500s looking instead of 1800s looking.
Yeah,
that's incredible.
I just wanted to show you that there's so much artwork, and I could do the same with Greek art on vases. I could do the same with India,
Egyptian,
sculptures, yeah, Egyptian artwork, and show it how it's connected to the stars, because it is. This is not just me dreaming this up. These, look at the correspondences are just, they jump out at you once you start to really understand the system.
So, is this artist drawing their own interpretation, or do they know about the stars, or have they been commissioned by someone else to draw it this way? Is it a giant mystery?
It's a mystery.
Man.
What I would say, Adam, is up through the, basically up until we got to, quote, modern art, to be an artist in Europe, you had to basically graduate from the Academy of Art, you had to first get accepted into the Academy. So you had to be good enough to get in there. Then you went and you learned, and then you became an artist. It was only like people like Picasso or Monet who started to like flaunt the conventions of the Academy. But for hundreds of years, art was, I believe, somewhat controlled. So what they learned in the Academy, I don't know. I need a time machine to go back to, 1600s.
Oh, Italy, I got you covered. I'm working on one. I'm building one now. You'll be the first to know, and we'll try it out.
Very dangerous time machines.
Yeah, make sure there's no flies around.
Yeah, time machines are very, very dangerous.
But
it's a great question, Adam. It's a great question. And I think it's not out of bounds to speculate that somehow they were taught some conventions. I mean, if you look at Da Vinci's art, when he has the Annunciation to Mary, and it's clearly celestial. The angel is on deep knee bend. Mary's got her arm extended out, and it relates to specific aspects of constellations. So yeah. Sacred artwork worldwide, but this is worldwide. Like I can show it to you in, sculptures and reliefs in India from the 200, time frame, or from the 1400 time frame, like all the way through centuries. So somehow this is getting preserved for centuries. Anyway, I'll stop the presentation there because I think that's probably enough to show what I'm trying to argue.
Yeah.
And explain.
Well, that was amazing, man. I want to encourage our listeners and viewers to explore this more. You should tell them about your website and your searchable blog and all of that, because I kind of want to invite you back to get straight to doing the screen share and just like spend 2 hours just having you show us pictures, because this is, I'm just mind blown. I think this is great stuff.
Yeah, I've loved
it. Yeah, but this isn't called Chud Gets Red Pilled. We need to know what Debra thinks.
One question. Why does Mary always have her arm out? I never realized that.
Because she's associated with Virgo. And Virgo, one of Virgo's distinctive features is an outstretched arm. I could show it to you.
Okay.
I could show it to you. But if you like rewind, if people are watching, if they rewind the tape, they can see Virgo has an outstretched arm. But I'll just quickly show it if you want. I didn't have any.
So they're making the quote unquote more modern art to fit the sky.
Well, I think modern art like broke with this tradition.
No, so, well, I meant like, you know, yes, 1800s yeah, art yes, or 1600s yes, art. They're. Yes.
Okay. I think they are. I think yeah, somehow it's being preserved, like for sacred subjects in general. Like if you're painting a Bible scene, then you somehow incorporate these start. Why? Uh-huh. Could it be collective unconscious? Yes, it could be collective unconscious. Could it be that they were taught that in the academy? Yes, it could be. You know, could this be that there are people who know this system that have been passing it down through the centuries? Absolutely, it could be. I'm not the recipient of any of that secret knowledge. I read Hamlet's Mill and became like obsessed and fascinated with trying to figure out more and more about the system. And I happen to have grown up with the books of H.A. Rey. Like that's how my dad showed me the stars. Was
oh, so you saw those system, a long time ago. Those,
oh, yeah, I grew those up were in your, those. Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome, man. I'm so glad I've picked up both of his books on the sky. And I'm sharing those with I have an 8-year-old and a 1.5-year-old. And yeah, the 8-year-old, we're in the Pacific Northwest. So we got a lot of cloudy nights, but yeah. we're grabbing it whenever we have a chance. And he liked looking at the stars before, but now he's excited when he sees that it's a clear sky. He's going, "Hey, I know it's light out late, but can we stay up tonight?
That's
because
great.
I want to take this outside." So that's awesome to hear that you had that when you were a kid too.
That is great. Yeah. I think it's just fantastic. I mean, it's a basically free hobby. Mm-hmm. If you're able to do it, I really encourage everyone to start to become familiar with the stars, but the books that you're referring to. So we mentioned H.A. Rey has The Stars, A New Way to See Them. And then he also has one, I think it's called Find the Constellations,
yeah,
which is geared for even younger, like one's more of a children's book. Like they're both suitable for children and adults, but it's like, if you're an adult, it's a great thing to go out. Like if you just go out, walk the dog at night or something, you know, throughout the year, you will start to become familiar if you use H.A. Rey's system. If you just use Wikipedia or the outlines in an app, a lot of times those outlines are horrific. It's like almost they're purposely bad.
Yeah, I recommend, well, not so much the younger one, but the New Way to Look at the Stars, I think is the one for yeah, older kids. I recommend that for all adults.
Everybody. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Like, it is awesome.
It's The Stars, A New Way to See Them. And it's right, like in its 14th or 15th edition. So it was first published in 52. It's like a super bestseller down through the years. I think it's one of the most important books ever written. Because with that book, you can see, even though he doesn't say it, you can start to see these connections. And so my website, you know, I do have dozens of videos that are free videos that are archived on my website. I do have a blog, like you mentioned, that has been going since 2011 and it's fully searchable, talking about a lot of the subjects, but a lot about this. So my website is starmythworld.com. And that's also my Instagram name, starmythworld. So on Instagram, you know, in the bio, you have that one link. I've got a link tree thing there on my Instagram where you can, the link tree has a series of links, and one of which is the blog, one of which is my YouTube channel, one of which is my courses, one of which is books, things like that. But they're also on that website. My courses are under, I call it the Undying Stars Academy. My second book was called The Undying Stars, which is a phrase from ancient Egypt, the Undying Stars. So I also have a website called undyingstars.com, which links to all my courses, but Starmyth World also links to the courses. And I'm going to keep working on that Undying Stars website, make it more of the flagship website in the future, maybe.
Excellent.
I've really, really enjoyed this, David. I want to thank you so much. This is a topic that I was kind of soured on early on in my awakening. So you've made it really accessible for somebody like me who is open to things but doesn't really understand very much, and your presentation was really, really good, and I'm really intrigued now, whereas before I could take it or leave it. So more right, mostly leave it. So I want to take it now.
I'm not trying to put down any other researchers. When I say shallow astrotheology, I get frustrated when it's, I believe this system is a tremendous heritage for humanity. Like, there's so many implications to this. And I believe that it is uplifting and positive. And so I get frustrated. Like, I say shallow astrotheology when it's like diminutive or reductive and saying, oh, this shows that, you know, the myths are just about this. They're clearly about something much more profound than they're about some very profound subjects having to do with recovery of self and overcoming trauma. And it's horrible that they can be inverted and used to inflict trauma, but it's kind of like, I say, it's kind of like Kung Fu or martial arts.
Yep.
You know, I think its intended benefit is to protect people from, you know, getting raped or from getting oppressed, but it could also be flipped around and used to oppress people and inflict violence. It should, you know, and that's what most Kung Fu movies are about. You've got the bad Kung Fu master who's using it the wrong way, and finally the good Kung Fu master comes along and says, okay, we're gonna have to put a stop to this oppression. So thanks for having me.
I really appreciate the fact that you say things like that's the mystery, or I don't know, or nobody knows. Best way to make me not believe anything you say is to have a definitive answer on it.
Thanks very much. Like I said, I think it's a very clear concept for the show. Adding the element of Deborah having to, you know, judge it is an excellent idea. It's a
All right, guys, we'll call it here. And, put all the links in the show notes there. Talk soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.